Welcome back to the Business of Government Hour. I'm Michael Keegan, your host, and our guest today is Brigadier General John Ferrari, Director of Program Analysis and Evaluation within the Office of the U.S. Army's Deputy Chief of Staff. General, would you outline for us the U.S. Army's key strategic and operational objectives and priorities? How do these priorities intersect and prompt the cultural change needed to meet the budget realities and the evolving threat environment?
Right. So that's a great question. So the Army has recently, General Odierno has, and the Secretary have put out a new Army operating concept, which is really about how the Army sees itself meeting the challenges of the nation over the next 10 years. And if you – just a quick history lesson. If you think back to the 80s during the Cold War when I came in, we had what's called Airland Battle Doctrine, which was really focused on defeating the Soviet threat in case of an attack. And it was a large mass army, hundreds of thousands lined up from the north of Germany to the south, ready to defend and act against the Soviet threat. What we then went to in the 2000s with the operations in Iraq and Afghanistan – was different than but similar in that we put a large part of the Army into one country. Mm-hmm. But instead of operating as a very large unit to defend a very large nation state attack, the Army was operating in a very decentralized manner against a more insurgent type threat. But it was still a very, 150,000 people in one country focused on a single mission, operating decentralized and in small units rather than large units. Where the Army sees itself going and where we've got to change to now is, and as we talked about a bit, is really operations around the world where you've got small groups of people in spread out throughout the entire world doing radically different things. So you've got a paratrooper company in Estonia, working with their army and their Ministry of Defense kind of in a deterrence mode. You've got a headquarters in a train and assist mission in Iraq helping the Iraqi army defeat a insurgent threat. You've got forces in Afghanistan. You've got – you're doing Ebola in Africa. You're doing – you've got operations going on, training and participating in partnership activities in the Pacific. So all the while preparing for major combat operations in case they happen, because that's the mission of the military is to be ready for those unknown contingencies. So the big difference now is how do you have that expeditionary small unit where you don't mass an army – but you disassemble it throughout the world for radically different missions, and that's what we're trying to do.
And one way you do that is to provide senior leadership with direct independent analysis of programs, alternatives, and priorities. So what I want to get to is, would you elaborate on how you actually do this analysis, what tools you use to provide these sorts of options, if you will, what-if scenarios?
Right. So first of all, the key tool that we use is talented people. Because if you don't have the people with the wide range of skill sets who can think analytically and then also understand how to use data and how resourcing and how politics work, you won't get to an answer. And so really we use a lot of different quantitative and qualitative tools to look at the challenge and the mission set, understand and decompose the problem set into actionable decisions where the leadership can then look at something, and we've done a lot of the work for them to say, hey, this is a complex problem, but it really boils down to these three or four issues that we're then able to take data, either wargaming analysis or data from a data from the resourcing database or readiness data, and you marry together the relevant information with the relevant decision that then enables whoever's going to make that decision to have all the information they need or the best information they can have at that time in order to decide what to do across a wide array of programs, everything from acquisition to hiring and firings and things like that.
So, General, what is the Program Objective Memorandum, POM, and what does it entail?
Yeah, so, POM is one of those great government words that, nobody would ever invent and nobody understands, right? So what essentially the POM, the Program Objective Memorandum, is, it's a it is a database that records decisions, resourcing decisions that aligns strategy and policies to actions. And I joke that when the Soviet Union was around, it had, the five-year plan that they would do. And when it left us here in DOD with a six-year or seven-year plan, right? So the it looks out 5 years into the future, but it also looks beyond, and it tries to take the programs and manpower so that you understand what you're buying today for weapon systems, what you're buying today for manpower, what you're buying today for readiness, and it projects it out to make sure you can live within the fiscal constraints that you have. And then it takes it and subjects it to war games and other scenario development to see if the force that you're building for 2020 and 25 can actually accomplish the anticipated missions that you're anticipated to get. So it's a very complex undertaking that it's not just a database, but it's the entire planning, programming, budgeting process.
Oh, really? Okay. So could you give us a sense, a glimpse into how your office, Program Analysis and Evaluation within the Deputy Chief of Staff of the Army, how it develops the investment strategy across the whole enterprise of the Army?
We look across really three broad portfolios, and we try to balance those. So the first is manpower. So the one thing about the Army that's different than the other services, the other services man their equipment. In the Army, we equip our manpower. So the Army is people. We are soldiers. Soldiers supported by a civilian workforce that organizes, trains, and enables it to go out and conduct operations. So what we generally first do as an Army is figure out what structure we need to accomplish the missions and how many people you have to do that, because that then takes up roughly about half of our budget on the military side. So once you decide then what structure you have, you then have to determine the capabilities and the modernization for it. What type of equipment will it have? How will you upgrade that equipment? How do you manage the investment portfolio? And the investment portfolio makes up, depending upon where you are in the kind of budget cycle, roughly 18 to 22% of the budget. So the other 30% of the budget then is our readiness funding. And in our readiness funding, that's everything from training to education to the logistics needed to support the force and the installations needed to run them. And so the real question and the real analysis that we do in PA&E is, well, how do you balance that? And what does balance even mean? What if you had too much, given a fixed fiscal environment and a fixed amount of dollars, how do you determine how many people you have and how modernized they are and how much readiness they should have? Because we have, and what we're going through now, the challenge the Army leadership has is we thought we were going to have $150 billion a year. We now, this year, are going to have 120. So that's a 20% budget reduction. Well, the question is, well, okay, so how does an organization shrink by 20%? Do you take risk in readiness? Well, the challenge we talked about, well, the world may or may not cooperate with that, right? Do you take risk in modernization so you don't modernize, right? Well, there are threats out there that are modernizing their forces. And as weapon systems become more infused with technology, right, technology is spinning so fast, they require more money to upgrade them. And then how big do you have the force? And so we have to, you know, we're in the process of shrinking the Army from what was the regular Army with 570,000 down to 490 at the end of this year. So in the last 4 years, we will have taken out 80,000 soldiers from the force. And once you take the manpower and the structure out, it's very hard. That's a long-term decision. I mean, it takes years and years to build it back. So it's fairly irreversible and not very elastic. So depending upon whether you feel the budget reductions are going to be long-term, short-term, you may decide to take some readiness risk. You may decide to take some structure risk or modernization. And you've got to work through all that and think through that, because what you don't want to do is wind up the one fear the Army has the most is being what we call a hollow Army. And by a hollow Army, and General Odierno will tell you, the one thing he worries about is getting a phone call from the president that says he's got to put a soldier in harm's way, and that soldier hasn't been properly trained and hasn't been properly equipped, or we put soldiers and we don't have enough of them. Unfortunately, our history as a nation is when the first battle occurs, we tend to be not ready, because we go through these boom and bust cycles of funding and we say, well, we're not going to do that again. And so in the Army's culture, that plays a very large role, because we know it's the soldiers that we send to war. If you get it wrong, they have to pay the price of the wrong decisions.
General, PA&E manages the programming phase of the Army's planning, programming, budget, and execution process. First, could you tell us more about the PPBE process in general, and then tell us a little bit more about your role in it?
The PPBE, as it's known inside the Pentagon, has survived for a very long time because, in theory, it does what it's supposed to. And what it's supposed to do is start with a long-term planning horizon. And that's where you've got a lot of the policy folks, the Undersecretary of Defense for Policy, a lot of the operations folks, the joint staff, the warfighters, and the combatant commanders kind of decide how they want to fight the force. And so they look out 10, 20, 30 years to do that. In theory, the planning phase gets done and hands it to the programming phase where I sit, which is then how do you take the resources you have, marry them to programs to get that force in the planning phase. And that's really called programming. But that's where a lot of the hard decisions are made in the trades of capabilities. It then transitions to the budget phase, which is then where the comptroller gets the program and turns it into appropriations so the president can submit it to Congress. Once the appropriation is done by Congress, it comes back to DOD to enter the fourth phase of the process, which is execution. And it's the feedback loop between all those cycles that actually each year happen that move the plan along. What makes it interesting and what makes it a four-dimensional chessboard is that, so if you look today in the department, we're doing planning for what we call POM 18. So it's looking at 2018 to 2022.
I wanted to ask you if you could explain the role of your organization serving as the executive agent for defending Army programs with the Office of the Secretary of Defense. What does that entail?
So as the executive agent for defending the budget, it's our duty in PA&E to justify to the Secretary of Defense's staff the resource decisions made by the Secretary of the Army and the Chief of Staff of the Army so that we wind up with at least the same amount of money we went in, certainly not less, and it's always helpful if you emerge with more money than you went in, but given the fiscal environment, right, kind of the best you can hope for is to hold even in that process. But it's a very interesting review in that all the services, all the combatant commanders, all the defense, everybody's around the table trying to provide the information that the Deputy Secretary of Defense and the Secretary of Defense need to decide which programs go forward and which don't to the Congress.
It's my understanding that the Army cannot adjust manpower fast enough to achieve balance across readiness, force structure, and modernization in the near term. I was wondering if you could explain in detail why that is the case and what are the implications of this scenario?
So fast enough is a relative term,
yeah,
right?
So
we've been, up till now, eliminating 20,000 soldiers a year. Some of these soldiers are being eliminated while they're in Afghanistan and deployed around the world, right? So it's a very painful and personal process. And you've got to be able to adjust the manpower, both the military and the civilian, at the same time you're conducting all of these global operations, right? So if you remember when we started, we said, hey, we didn't anticipate to be in Iraq. We didn't anticipate to be in the Baltics. And so while you're reducing the force and the manpower, the force is still in motion. And so you've got to close units, you know, kind of like factories. But when we go into an installation and say that unit's going away, unlike a factory, we don't say, well, everybody in that unit's fired, right? We have boards and procedures. And so we look across the Army to retain the very best we can. And so it induces you have to move people around in order to cover the holes of the reductions. Now, that's been enormously stressful on the force and has really driven readiness levels down at a time we're still cycling. And so the Secretary of Defense made the decision to slow that down just a bit. So instead of separating 20,000 soldiers a year, we're going to separate 15 over the next couple of years per year. But we were on a path from 2012 to 2019 under full sequestration to reduce 20,000 people a year for seven straight years. So when people say, well, you can't reduce – well, sure, I guess we could do like we did at the end of World War II or at the end of the Cold War and let 100,000 people go in a year. But that's not very humane. We've never done that to really an all-volunteer force, and especially a force that's been at war for 10 years. And the talent you're letting go, once you let it go, it takes 10 years to grow back, especially those mid-grade officers and non-commissioned officers. That's a lot of talent. So we're bringing it down as fast as we think is possible in the global environment we're in. The challenge is, if you're only coming down a couple of percent every year, our budget came off a cliff. We went from 150 to 120. So your budget is gone, and 20% of it's gone. And if your manpower, which makes up 50% of your budget, is coming down at a rate not coming off a cliff, that means your modernization accounts and your training accounts have to bear the brunt of that drawdown. We still don't know where we're going to end for end strength across the active component, the guard, the reserve, or the civilian workforce, because we don't know where we're going to land with, will we be at the president's budget? Will we be at sequestration? So over the next couple of years, whether we wind up at a 920,000 army across all three components, active, guard, or reserve, or 980,000, which is where we're currently planned to be under the president's proposal, well, that's 60,000 people who we don't know whether we're going to retain or separate in 2018 and 2019. So we're working through all that, but you've got to meet payroll. So in the short term, you've got to pay people. The flexibility comes in canceling acquisition programs and reducing the amount of money you spend on installations, facilities maintenance, weapons maintenance, and in training.
General, I just had a follow-on, and I was wondering, when you're talking about drawdown of people, what about recruitment? What happens to recruitment in that kind of a scenario?
Right. So that's a very interesting question, and there are a couple of ways to go about it. So one way to draw down, which we did in the 90s, was to shut off the recruitment pipeline, right? So one way to get smaller is just don't bring people in. You don't have to separate as many people, right, because you're not bringing as many in. What we learned from that experience was while we were trying to protect the career force by not separating them at as high a rate as would have been necessary, still a very high rate, and shutting off recruitment, you create a talent dip in the force for 5 or 10 years that you can never, ever recover from. And we paid that price at the beginning of this war in 2000 and 2005 because it turned out we were missing a large chunk of our mid-grade NCOs and officers because we never hired them. So what we said on this time around is we're going to try not to do that. We're going to still bring in what we're not going to what we call under-recruit. Right? We'll bring in what we need for the force we need, which means then you have to separate more people at the mid and senior grades. So tell people you've served honorably, but you're going to have to retire, or, you know, we're going to have to separate you at 10 years or we won't let you reenlist. So we're still bringing in 60,000 enlisted soldiers a year. Now, in order to slow the drawdown down from 20,000 to 15,000, right, we didn't do that by just not separating people. We're going to increase the accession mission to keep up with that so that you keep bringing in the next generation of leaders.
How is the Army restructuring its aviation portfolio? We will ask Brigadier General John Ferrari, Director of Program Analysis and Evaluation within the Office of the U.S. Army's Deputy Chief of Staff, when our conversation continues on the Business of Government Hour.